Welcome everyone to Bitcoin OpTech newsletter number 299 recap on Twitter Spaces. Today is going to be a discussion about weak blocks. We're going to talk about the five new BIP editors, including someone that we know very well. We have also have five Stack Exchange questions and also our usual weekly release and notable code segments. I'm Mike, contributor at OpTech, executive director at Brink. Merch.
Hi, I'm Merch. I work full-time at Chaincode Labs on Bitcoin projects, and since of Monday, I'm a BIP editor.
InstaGibbs?
Hi, I'm Greg, or InstaGibbs. I'm at Spiral.
Greg, thanks for joining us this week. We have your news item as the first item in the newsletter. For those following along, you can look at the tweets in the space or bring up Bitcoin OpTech Newsletter 299, the news section. First one, weak blocks, proof of concept implementation. Greg, this is your post to delving, and you resurrected sort of this old idea of weak blocks, which I'll let you introduce. It's not something that I was actually very familiar with before you brought it up again, so maybe you can introduce it to everybody.
Yeah, sure. It's definitely got some history. I'd forgotten how long ago it was. This is like kind of the heat up of the block size wars, discussions about within the community, the Bitcoin community, which is pre-split. So you had people who are sympathetic to larger blocks, and they're trying to figure out how to work through this. And so weak blocks was basically one idea, a family of ideas to reduce the marginal orphan rate for blocks that get larger. So if you wanted blocks to get like 10 megabytes, 100 megabytes, how could you do this? Oh, go ahead, Merch.
Stale block rate.
Okay, stale block rate. So if blocks are like 10 times as large, then basically the chances of your block being becoming stale go up, and this has kind of nonlinear effects depending on how big you are as a mining pool. So if stale rates go up, the incentives are much higher to join into larger and larger pools until you get 51% or even more. So this is one big concern that people had, and they're thinking about how could you use essentially this, you'd send around mining shares. So a mining pool or these miners would basically have near misses. So let's say instead of a full proof of work required for a consensus valid block, you get 1/10 or something like that. That would be still a lot of proof of work, and you'd send these shares around the peer-to-peer network, and these shares would essentially hint at what miners are working on. And so you can imagine if you had like 100 of these coming in between every real block, that you could get a good sense of what is going to be in the next block. And these proposals also use like differential coding schemes, like, okay, the first weak block, maybe it has everything in it. Or the second weak block tells you the delta from the first weak block, the third, the delta from the second, and so on and so forth. This would compress it further, but it also would require like strict ordering and kind of like extra consensus layer on top, complicating the protocol. And this is, again, back when people were thinking maybe we should soft work in some of these ideas to kind of consensus enforce these things. And as also a reminder, this is about 2015 when a lot of this, I dropped a few links in the Delving post, but this is before Compact Blocks was at least deployed. I'm not sure, I don't remember how far the spec had come along by then, because I was pretty early and I was just getting into the development space in 2015. But it's around the same time as it was being specified. The BIP 152 for weak compact blocks was around 2016 or the end of 2015. And so that's some basic history. Merch, is your hand still up, or is that just like an old?
That seems to be an error in your GUI.
Okay. All right. So that's kind of like the weak blocks idea. I'll stop there for any clarifications required for the weak blocks, kind of the historical idea.
Maybe just a tangent and not necessarily a clarification of that. When you're talking about the deltas between these weak blocks, when people were talking about that, is that, you know, something that comes to mind is like set reconciliation, like the Erlay
kind of
tech? Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll circle back to this. I think you could do a version of this with weak weak blocks, even without adding like global consensus to this, maybe a per link differential, but it's something for future work.
Okay. I think that's a good opportunity for you to continue. Sorry for the distraction.
Right. No problem. So this leads into compact blocks. In the interim, we've had compact blocks deployed, and it keeps, basically it's a scheme to when a new full proof of work block comes in, nodes tell each other about this new block in a compact way. Basically, a compact block, it includes the header as well as per link short transaction IDs. So basically, the transaction ID list for the entire block, but in a shortened way that's salted per link. So you can make it even smaller while still being safe. And this allows the receiving node, this compact block, to, if they're lucky, if they have everything in their mempool or held somewhere, they can fill out the entire block with this kind of just sketch and then continue forwarding it to next nodes. And so this would be a half a round trip block update versus a number of round trips. And this makes the network converge faster on the new chain tip, which then allows miners to mine on the most profitable thing, regardless of how much hash power they have. Again, this is to reduce like accidental selfish mining and speed up network convergence.
I think that a useful analogy would be, instead of sending around the entire block, you send a recipe on how to cook the block from your own mempool. And then if you're missing any ingredients, you ask your peers, hey, I'm missing that transaction, could you hand it over? So right. It's a way more compact form of getting everybody the same cake.
Yeah, prior to compact blocks, what would happen is the new block comes in, and old way is you'd send them a hash and say, hey, I have this new block. And then you'd say, hey, give me the full block, and they give you the full block. But at 4 megabytes, you already probably have almost everything in your mempool, and you're just wasting bandwidth. And there's all this back and forth. And 4 megabytes is too large just to unilaterally send, right? So you can't get the same. It's also just larger, right? So it comes in more, like it just has more latency inherent there as well. So reducing it to optimistically a half a round trip and being quite small, right? So this can speed up quite a bit, right?
So with the weak blocks going around, your idea is we can use compact blocks again, and we basically give recipes of people's block templates ahead of time. And that would allow everyone to get the transactions they're working on before the block is found.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I haven't gotten to the kind of modern motivation. So rather than thinking about scaling block sizes, I was thinking more about how network mempool policies are maybe diverging, and there's some examples, right? So recently we saw transaction prioritization, right? So via BTC prioritized a bunch of transactions which don't actually go in, wouldn't actually be entered into a normal mempool, normal meaning 300 megabyte mempool default, because they're so low. But suddenly a block full of these shows up, and then all the nodes on the network are basically missing these few thousand transactions and have to go fetch them in a round trip. There's also things like some nodes are doing mempool full RBF, some are not. Some are filtering inscriptions, some are not. Some have limited op return limits, or like 80 bytes, or some have unbounded. There's some that have different dust limits, so different transaction output Satoshi value limits. Some have none, some have non-zero. And then there's also just like more experimental things like different replacement policies, right? So all these things mean that potentially when, like, let's say Ocean Mining finds a block, they might have a significantly different mempool than my node. And if I'm a miner, I want the update as fast as possible so I can start building on top. And so basically with this kind of motivation in mind, what if we just reuse compact blocks infrastructure, but reuse them in a weak sense? So instead of, we just have a slightly different code path saying, hey, I have gotten a block that is, you know, a tenth of the proof of work. What if I can gossip these compact blocks around? Yeah, Merch, is that a fresh hand up? Sorry. Okay, no, it's just a UI thing. Okay. Yeah, so the main discussion, you know, in the Delving thread is mostly about kind of motivation, how it would be structured, and then also just the design trade-offs. There's a lot of things that would have to be decided. For example, how many updates per between each block should we be expecting? How much, you know, do we have to send every weak block we find, or do we need a rate limit in some way? What do we do with the weak block? So in my implementation, I basically get a weak block. As soon as it's completed, I do the round trip fetching of the transactions that are missing. As soon as it's completed, I first of all protect all those transactions, but I also try to enter them into the mempool because maybe I just haven't heard about it. So that's kind of a mempool sync thing. So you have to think about like all these things. Do we want, what do we do? What do we don't want to do? There's also discussion about, you know, does this actually incentivize miners to do things? So for example, if a miner wants to hide a transaction, they're incentivized not to do this scheme. So there's, for example, I think Marathon has their slipstream service, and one of their advertised points is that they hide these transactions because they're doing BRC20 token issuances and there's MEV involved there. So they're kind of pinky swearing that they won't tell anyone about these transactions. So that's kind of like an interesting incentives problem mismatch maybe there.
Yeah, I was thinking about that and the flip side. So you have Marathon that doesn't want to share that information potentially for various reasons. So they don't want to participate. And then there's folks, let's say like the ocean side of things, where they don't want to see, well, I guess eventually they see it in a block, but they don't want to see they don't want to see relayed spam garbage. And I guess what this is saying is, great, you won't see transaction relay garbage, but you're going to see like sort of this half, these half block garbages, and you have to go download it anyways. Or how would that work?
Right. So one thing is, let's say you're ocean. You would see the transactions in this new message type, but you, again, you would not have to add them to your mempool or include them in a block. This is primarily a way of reducing latency and block network convergence. So I think to argue against this, you'd essentially have to say, I'm not saying this is what they'd say, but let's say you're against inscriptions, you want to filter them at the peer-to-peer layer. If you start penalizing block relay to penalize inscriptions, that's essentially what you're doing. So you might as like, you're arguing against fast convergence of the network. And I think that's pretty problematic, because if that's the case, there are many ways we could make it worse, right? An inscription filtering node might just literally put a penalty on a block. If it gets a new block that has an inscription, it could put a timeout penalty on it, right? Slow it, you know, don't accept this for 1 second. And I'm trying not to give bad ideas here, but that I think it's functionally equivalent here to rejecting this idea from that perspective, at least.
You mentioned as part of the motivation, diverging mempool policies on the network and that resulting in delays for final block propagation. Is there a good place to see those metrics or charts showing that, or is that just more of a, that we sort of know that's happening based on the divergent mempools?
There's no central location because every node has its own view of the mempool. But one thing I do with my node is I take a look at it. There's a compact block logging flag you can turn on, and it tells you basically these stats. So every time a block comes in, it says how many transactions were there in the compact block, how many did you have in your mempool, how many did you have in this special, there's a special kind of holding cell called the extra compact block transactions. It's kind of a verbose name, but extra transactions. But this is like just 100 transactions total. And then it says, how many did you request from your peer? So you can see how many you ended up not ever hearing about or having cached. And so you can think about it from that perspective, that if, you know, if we had compact weak compact blocks, how many times would this non-zero value of missed transactions go to zero? And I think that's kind of the primary motivation there. The thing is, it's hard to test, right? You don't know until miners start sending out these transactions or advertising these transactions in like maybe a mining template. So the one big piece here is like, would miners want to run this? Because they would have to plug into this. And how much work would it take to integrate with such a system? So these are big open questions that I do not have answers for.
I mean, if miners got paid for getting a confirmation and the transaction gets confirmed in someone else's block, they should be happy, right? I mean, they didn't put aside the block space in their own block and they still got paid. On the other hand, altogether, this seems to only solve the one side of the problem, the one where a transaction has already gotten to miners and we want the network to hear about that transaction as soon as possible in order for blocks to propagate quickly. And we want other miners to also hear about any substantially interesting transactions that might be available among any miners. But it doesn't address, of course, the question, what happens if some people want to send transactions that are currently non-standard? How do they get to miners in the first place? What do we want to do about that, and so forth?
Yes, it's very true. So in that delving thread also, Bob hops in and does a little pitch about Braid Pool. So if you're interested in a more advanced solution, which is supposedly, I don't know how to do the game theory analysis here, but the intention is for Braid Pool to be a place where you're incentivized to share all these essentially weak blocks. And so Braid Pool uses a form of weak blocks, but in a kind of mining pool based consensus format. So please take a look at that if you're interested kind of this direction going further. But I have a feeling that's a lot of engineering work beyond what I've proposed, which is, you know, you can take a look how much code I've proposed. But
what is a DAG?
Directed acyclic graph. So let's see. So like a Bitcoin transactions conform DAGs. There's no cycle. So a transaction can't spend itself, in other words, or its transaction descendant or ancestor can't spend a descendant's output. So if you have weak blocks, you can basically form a kind of proof of work DAG instead of a chain, the linear chain. And this would allow you to basically make a partial ordering of all these weak blocks to pay out to miners in some proportional fashion. Ethereum, at least back when it was proof of work, had a minor version of this with uncles, but they don't have that anymore with proof of stake, I think.
You outlined some next steps. Maybe you want to talk about that for the audience.
Oh, so I'd have to open the post for that. But one would be, I think the two were basically look at kind of what people think about it, right? Because I talked to some people in private about it as like a motivation idea, but seeing what people were working on. So some feedback I've gotten is, you know, from Bob saying, hey, would be better if we incentivize even large miners to share transactions. Some other feedback I've gotten is basically that maybe the things like MEV, or as BlueMet calls MEVIL, that maybe that's the largest concern these days. And so we should just first work on relaxing relay policies as much as possible while staying safe as kind of a vector to make sure Bitcoin Core stock miners are making the most money. So that's like another piece of feedback I got. And lastly, I would need, if I wanted to continue this further, I'd have to approach miners, right? Because if miners don't run this, it's not helpful. So this is beholden on miners actually doing uptake, and I need to figure out if there's market fit at all for this. So
and it's miners, like you wouldn't need to have anything done at the pool level, right? It's the individual hashers.
Well, it depends, right? Let's say I'm a miner who's just blind mining off of a, you know, I'm doing Stratum V1. I'm blind mining off of just a header hash, right?
Yeah.
You have to be able to at least see what's in the block to help with this, right? So Stratum V2 or something like it, where at least you get to see what you're mining on is at least necessary, maybe not even sufficient.
Merch?
Yeah, I wanted to chime in on that too.
Yeah, but that's, I've never done mining, so this is like one big, I see Portland HODL here. So that's one big question I would have to do some market research on.
Rich, any other questions before we move on?
Nope, all good.
Greg, thanks for joining us to talk about this. You're welcome to hang out, or if you have things to do and drop, we understand.
My pleasure. I'll hang around.
Next news item titled BIP Editors Update. So after a lot of discussion on the mailing list, there are 5 new BIP editors. Konzer, John Attack, our co-host here, Merch, Roast Beef, and Ruben Thompson. Merch, you're sort of on the inside of some of this, or you're a direct participant in it anyways. So, well, I guess congratulations, but maybe also give us some insight about what do you think about becoming an editor? What have you noticed so far? And maybe how you're going to approach this responsibility that you have now.
Well, I think all of us have noticed that the BIP repository has been moving a bit more quickly in the past few days. I've looked up some stats for us here. 91 pull requests have been commented or updated since Monday. 54 pull requests have been closed, either by merging them or by closing the pull request. 3 BIP numbers have been assigned, 1 BIP has been merged, and we're down to 98 pull requests from originally 142, with a few new ones being opened since. So I think that just throwing a little more manpower at the problem has definitely helped get some eyes on some stuff that was ready to be merged. We've also revised BIP 2 very slightly in the sense that there was a pull request open since 2017 that suggested the addition of BIP editors may merge a change to a BIP that doesn't change the meaning. So in the sense that if there's, for example, a typo, or if there's like a broken link that where a file just moved and it's obvious what the file was and that it was just restructured in the project that was linked to or something. Making fixes like that where you do not put words in the mouth of the BIP editor, but just add the missing character to fix a typo or something like that, we can merge now. And that took care by itself to allow us to merge something like 30 pull requests that were just making minor touch-ups on open stuff that just shouldn't linger for 7 years. There's no reason for that to take that long if it's just fixing a typo. So I think that the BIP process is, we're still guided by BIP 2, of course. It's a little more flexible than it was last week in the sense that a lot of these really, really tiny pull requests have been addressed. I think it'll take a little longer once we are through the low-hanging fruits. We still have to get to the bigger things. Like there's a number of actual BIP proposals open that have to be read and that might need some feedback, like some things haven't been posted to the mailing list yet, which is a requirement in the BIP process for getting merged. There's also some discussion about whether or not relay policy is BIPable at all, because it is the position of some participants that relay policy is a per node decision and therefore shouldn't be standardized. So I think we're looking into what exactly the state is of affairs, and we're collecting some ideas in how BIP 2 could be improved upon by being less vague and more explicit in what exactly we require and how it is to be interpreted. So as some of you might have seen on the mailing list, there's been a discussion on what the BIP process should entail and some ideas on how to update it. So potentially there might be an effort by some people to write a new BIP that sort of has a more modern take on BIP 2, on like what the role of the editors are, what the process is, what the requirements for something to be published as a BIP are. On my personal wish list in that regard would be that, for example, value judgments would get a little more boxed in. For example, what does it mean if a BIP sticks with the philosophy of Bitcoin? I think that's very hard to decide for a single editor, because there's probably as many opinions on what exactly Bitcoin is as there's Bitcoin users. So, if you're interested in participating in what the BIP process should be, please check out the Bitcoin developer mailing list, where there's a thread ongoing. And yeah, I hope that someone decides to put some elbow grease into starting to write a successor to BIP 2. That would be wonderful. Otherwise, maybe some people that are involved in the BIP editorship might take a crack at it eventually, but hey, you could do it too.
It's still very early with all the new editors, and I'm excited to see what happens of that. But I guess we can all say now, thank you, Merch, for your time in doing this. I know you are already probably full with all of your contributions in space. So thanks for doing this.
Absolutely. I think it's been more gratifying than I thought, because it's been such a frustrating process for so many people for so long. So it just being moving is pretty cool.
Speaking of all your contributions in the space, you are also a moderator at the Bitcoin Stack Exchange, which is the next segment from the newsletter, our monthly segment on interesting Stack Exchange Q&A. How long have you been doing that now, Merch?
Now over 10 years.
Wow. Okay. Awesome. Well, we have five questions this month that we've highlighted in the segment. First one is, where exactly is the off by one difficulty bug? And this was actually a question on the Stack Exchange from 2014, but I noticed in my combing the Stack Exchange that Antoine, who's working on some related work, recently provided an additional follow-up answer to the question. He didn't point to a line of code per se, but in his answer, he explains the off by one error, which I'll digest here. He explains that in order to see how long it took to mine 2016 blocks during a difficulty period, that the Bitcoin Core software looks at the difference in time between the first block of the period and the last block of the difficulty period. The problem is that only measures how long it took to mine 2015 blocks, not 2016 blocks. In order to see the 2016 blocks worth of time, you'd actually need to go and look at the last block from the previous difficulty adjustment period. And that's possible for all of the difficulty adjustment periods so far in Bitcoin's history, except for one, which was the first adjustment period in the weeks after Bitcoin's launch, which wouldn't have a last block of the previous period to look at because there was nothing before the Genesis block. So that would have been a special case to handle, that first period. So Antoine hypothesizes that maybe Satoshi didn't want to complicate the code with this special case for the first two-week difficulty period, or maybe Satoshi did not notice the off-by-one error with his code. Merch, I'll pause there. Are we on the right track in describing this off-by-one?
Excellent work so far.
Okay, great. So now, looking at that, we're off by one block out of 2016 blocks. So I guess that seems like a small proportion, so who cares? We're a little bit undercounting time, and we're slightly biasing as a result towards adjusting the difficulty a bit more than it should have, but is that it? And Antoine wraps up his answer with noting, no, that's actually not it. Those small differences are not why anybody would care about this off by one. Actually, the time war bug is related to this off by one error as well. We talked about the time warp bug as part of the Great Consensus cleanup being revived when we had Antoine on in our podcast and newsletter in 296. Merch, it's up to you if you want to jump into the time warp bug here or if we just want to point people to 296. What do you think?
Oh, I can give it another quick riff. So basically the problem is if you're looking at the last 2016 blocks, you would be looking at the time from the last block in the previous period to the last block in the current period. So the time of the last block would matter for the current period. However, in the off by one, since the last block of the period is only looked at once, you can actually shift the last block of the previous period versus the first block of the next period, and therefore shift the two time blocks, not time blocks, periods independently. So if you shift the first block, you shift the first block earlier, but pick the last block in the period as at the current time. And as you shift the first block earlier and earlier, because the rules permit you to use any timestamp that is higher than the median of the previous 11, which means that you really only have to increase the timestamp by 1 second for each block, you would be able to stretch the perceived time more and more in each period, and that of course would reduce the difficulty more and more, and you would be able to mine the rest of all the block subsidies in something like 6 weeks. So basically just making these two periods overlap would be a trivial fix to this, because now if you shifted the last block back, you'd also shorten the next period. If you shift the last block forward, you get a higher difficulty in the next period, but because it looks like it's been shorter, right? So the lack of the overlap is really what enables this time warp. And we talked about this in the context of the great consensus cleanup. The fix is pretty simple too. We can soft fork it in. We just require that the time difference between the last block and the current block doesn't exceed some period of time, and that limits how you could use this off by one error in order to modify the difficulty adjustment.
Excellent, Merch. Thank you. Next question from the Stack Exchange. How is pay to taproot different than pay to public key hash in terms of using opcodes from a developer perspective? Merch, you answered this question, so I'll let you take the lead on what you think that this person was asking or getting at with their question and how you answered it.
Yeah, sure. I guess the fundamental misunderstanding here is that some of the address types commit to a very specific template, and the only malleable thing, or the thing that can be modified about the template, is which key plugs in, whereas other output templates allow you to have an arbitrary script that you commit to with a script hash. And pay to public key hash is, of course, one of the former, which means if you change the template in any way beyond just using a different public key, it's not a pay to public key hash address anymore. And so what this person wanted to do is, would it be possible to basically have a ordinals envelope or inscription envelope in pay to public key hash? And no, that's obviously not possible, because it would modify the output script in a way that it doesn't match the pay to public key hash template anymore. So what you need in order to have some sort of envelope like this would be a script hash type output or pay to taproot, which is both, right? Pay to taproot allows you to have a public key based spending with the key path spend, and a script based spending with the script path spend. And of course, the envelope is included in the script path and is committed to in the previous output script. So that's how the envelope works, and that's not compatible with pay to public key hash. Did I get that completely, or did I miss something?
I think you got it all. Yeah. Thanks for walking us through that. Next question. Are replacement transactions larger in size than their predecessors, and are they larger than non-RBF transactions? The latter question is easier to answer, since transactions signaling replaced by fee, BIP 125, are no larger than any transactions not signaling BIP 125. And that's because the bits that are used for signaling replacement are always present in a transaction, regardless of if you're signaling or not. It's actually using the end sequence number. And so there's no additional space used for signaling or not signaling. So they're the same size. And then in terms of the former question, are the replacement transactions larger than the original transactions that are being replaced? Wojciech answered this in that there's scenarios in depending on if you what you're replacing about the transaction that you could end up with a sized transaction that's the replacement is bigger than the original or the same size as the original or smaller than the original. And when we're talking about size, we're talking about the actual bytes size of the weight of the transaction, not the amount of Bitcoins moving around in the transaction. So it could get bigger, smaller, or stay the same. Merch, you may have more to add there.
Yeah, I mean, you could just run the statistics and get a decent answer on that. And if someone wants to do that, that would certainly be interesting and make for a great blog post. But there is no requirement for RBF transactions to be bigger. And I think that's the main point here. You can do whatever you want. You can replace a bigger transaction with a smaller transaction. You can replace a smaller transaction with a bigger transaction. As long as you fulfill the BIP 125 rules, which have requirements on both the fee rate increasing and the absolute fee increasing. So if you're going, for example, from a big transaction with a low fee rate to a small transaction with a higher fee rate, you may need to pay a significantly higher absolute fee, significantly higher fee rate in order to pay a higher absolute fee.
I saw B10C in here earlier, and someone also invoked B10C in one of the comments of the answer. When you talk about it would be nice to see some plot of this information, B10C would be a great individual to provide that. He was in here a second earlier. I guess we missed him. Maybe he's working on something like that. Are Bitcoin signatures still vulnerable to nonce reuse? So I guess maybe we should explain what are nonces. In computer science, nonces are an arbitrary number that's used one time in cryptographic communication. And in Bitcoin signature land, not only are those numbers used once, but they're numbers that must be used only once. And why? Because if you reuse the same nonce with two different signatures, the two signature equations can be combined and sort of canceled out using some basic algebra. The nonce can be canceled out, and then you solve for only a single value in the algebraic equation, which would be the private key. And so you want to make sure you avoid nonce reuse. And that applies, and I think this is what the person asking the question was getting at, that applies to Schnorr signatures as well. So when we added Schnorr signatures to the protocol, that did not eliminate concerns about nonces. And also many of the multi-signature variants like MUSIG2 also need to account for nonces for the same reason that you're worried about it and nonce reuse with single sig.
Small correction. So reusing nonces alone is not sufficient to lose your private key. You have to reuse the nonce in the context of the same private key for different messages. So you have to sign two different messages with the same private key and the same nonce. And then, yes, it's a simple system of equations where you can solve for the private key. And people might wonder why this both affects Schnorr signatures and ECDSA signatures. Well, the interesting thing is that after Schnorr put a patent on his Schnorr signatures, people really liked the scheme but wanted to not pay patent fees for it. So they came up with ECDSA as a response to Schnorr, which is essentially the same idea with a little bit of a convoluted overhead added that allowed for some of the interesting properties of Schnorr signatures to be used patent-free, but for example, caused the signatures no longer to be linear. So for example, why MUSIG is available now with Schnorr signatures but would be very difficult to implement with ECDSA is because the Schnorr signatures are linear and that allows them to be added together which with a more complex scheme is even secure, and with ECDSA would be way more complex.
Last stack exchange question. How do miners manually add transactions to a block template? And Ava Chow answered this question, providing two different potential ways that manual transactions could be added into a block template. The first one would be if you're using Bitcoin Core's block template, you can use the send raw transaction RPC to get that transaction into the miner's mempool and then adjust the priority of that transaction, which essentially manipulates the perceived absolute fee for the block building template algorithm. And you could use that prioritized transaction RPC on that new transaction that the miner added to the mempool in order to give it an artificially high fee rate so that it ends up getting mined, even though from a fee rate perspective, it might not have normally. That's the first route. And then the second route that a miner could use is they could change the get block template in Bitcoin Core to modify it to do something slightly different, or they could have a totally separate block building software in scheme and setup, totally separate from Bitcoin Core. Merch, thoughts on block building?
Yeah, I think that just using the prioritized transaction RPC is probably the avenue that is used by most, because I mean, it's right there. It is already in the node software that builds templates. I don't know if there's actually a block template building software out there that is widely used by miners beyond Bitcoin Core. Most of the blocks that we see on the, or almost all blocks that we see on the network are consistent with like the ordering, how Bitcoin Core would do it. So I assume that it's mostly prioritized transactions.
There's one release this week, which is LND version 0.17.5 beta, which is a maintenance release, and it gets LND compatible with the recent Bitcoin Core 27.0 release. Merch, I was messaging to you earlier that I am not exactly clear on the interplay here. It sounds like there's LND, there's BTCD, and then there's Bitcoin Core. And Bitcoin Core added a PR that limited max fee rates to a certain amount. And because of a bug on the BTCD side of things, potentially that they had a higher max fee rate. And now because Core is enforcing that, there's now an error when people go to send transactions. But I don't get how those three pieces of software are interplaying. Did you get a chance to look into that?
I did stare a bit at that. So my understanding is that BTCD was using Satoshis per kilobyte, whereas Bitcoin was using Bitcoin per kilo V byte. So that by itself would be a factor of 100 million difference. But then how that problem actually became an impediment for LND to send its transactions was apparently LND uses the send raw transaction RPC to submit transactions to Bitcoin Core in order to broadcast them to the Bitcoin network when, of course, Bitcoin Core is used as a backend. And by introducing this new maximum fee rate, the way that send raw transactions was being called by LND that used the max fee rate parameter in the send raw transaction call now caused LND to call it with a max fee rate that was higher than the permitted range by Bitcoin Core. So the send raw transaction call could have been completely fine if the max fee rate wasn't explicitly being raised to an out-of-bound figure. So essentially the fix was to just reduce the glass ceiling that they were passing in into the send raw transaction to the values permitted by Bitcoin Core, which is still a very high fee rate. And then the send raw transactions could succeed again.
Okay, that makes sense. So there's a parameter of send raw transactions that indicates like the fee rate max, and that was too big and the check was failing on the Bitcoin Core side as a result. Did I have that right?
That's how I understand it, yeah.
Great. It looks like the reported issue to LND that this was a potential concern was March 20th. So someone doing some of the release candidate testing potentially that we encourage folks to do had found that and opened up the PR/issue to L&D to get that fixed. It looks like it came out a little bit after 27.0, so maybe a little too slow on the fix. I did see some chatter about that on Twitter, so I don't know if there's a lesson learned there. Merch, do you think, were the Bitcoin Core developers aware of this issue on the L&D side of things?
I was not. I guess that, well, I can only encourage people that depend on Bitcoin Core software in their setup and backend that they involve themselves in the release candidate testing. Clearly, everyone that updates to software that depend, especially if they depend on it for like managing money, should check the release notes before they update. And when they see stuff that is potentially concerning, they might want to test it on testnet first before updating their production systems. I think that if that was an issue and that should have maybe delayed the release or caused the L&D release to be quicker, that should have been raised a little more loudly. Or, well, I'm not really that involved in the release process. Maybe the maintainers were aware. But anyway, it seems like it could have been fixed by a little more communication and or a little more heads up looking into it earlier.
We have one notable code change that we covered this week. I'll take the opportunity, if anybody has any questions on weak blocks or some of the stuff we spoke about today, you can request speaker access. We'll get to you at the end, or you can post your comment in the Twitter thread here. Bitcoin Core 29.850, which limits the maximum number of IP addresses accepted from an individual DNS seed to 32 per query. So when you're starting up your Bitcoin node for the first time, your node needs to figure out what other nodes are there on the network to peer with. One way to discover peers is querying a list of hard-coded DNS seeds, and these DNS seeds then return a bunch of IP addresses of Bitcoin nodes, which you can then choose to peer with your node, or that your node will automatically peer with. The data limit when you're querying via DNS limits the number of IP addresses that the DNS seed recommends to you to a max of 33 IP addresses, based on the just limits of querying via DNS. However, you can also query DNS seeds using TCP, which does not have the same data limit. And in theory, the DNS seed could return 256 IPs or more, but 256 is the limit in Bitcoin Core's net.cpp networking-related code. So in theory, one of the seeds could give you 256 IP addresses. So if any of the seeds decided to return 256 recommended IP addresses, and those 256 could be malicious peers, then results from that single DNS seed would take over more than half of the outgoing addresses used by the node. So that's obviously a concern, because it would increase the vulnerability of the node to Eclipse attacks, where an attacker can...
Oh, I lost you.
Sorry, I had an incoming phone call. So you don't want to have a bunch of IP addresses recommended to you from a potentially malicious peer, because you'd be more vulnerable to an Eclipse attack. So this PR changes what was a 256 hard-coded limit from a single seed to 32 IP addresses that the node will accept from a given DNS seed. That was a lot of rambling, Merch. What do you think?
That sounds really smart. That way we will be more likely to get a diverse selection, because we're asking all the DNS seeds. Each of them gives us 32. There's not going to be one DNS seed that stuffs our try list with a ton of nodes. And yeah, well, we only do this once when we sign up to the Bitcoin network at the very first time. And then after that, of course, every peer that we connect to, we ask for more addresses. So I think as long as there is a single good address in those, or maybe not a single, but a few good addresses across all the DNS seeds, this should be more safe this way.
Don't see any questions or requests for speaker access, so I think we can wrap up. Thank you, Greg Sanders, for joining us and talking about weak blocks. And thanks always to my co-host and BIP editor and Stack Exchange moderator, Merch.
Thanks. It was a great show. See you next week.
Cheers.